Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Hemingway's Passions, His Women, His Wars, and His Writing by Nancy W. Sindelar. Foreword by Mariel Hemingway. Narrated by Callie Bollier. No matter how being in love comes out, it's sure worth it all while it's going on. Author's note: The use of letters. Ernest Hemingway and his friends, family, wives, and lovers were prodigious letter writers. While they never intended for their correspondence to be published, their letters shed invaluable light on the thoughts and emotions that influenced their relationships. Though Ernest said he wrote letters because it's fun to get letters back, he left clear directives to his heirs that his correspondence should never be published. Refer to the epilogue. However, 20 years after his death, his fourth wife and literary executor, Mary Welsh Hemingway, authorized the 1981 publication of Ernest Hemingway, Selected Letters, 1917 through 1961, edited by Carlos Baker. And in 2011, his son Patrick and the Hemingway Foundation gave permission for the extensive Hemingway Letters Project, conducted by Sandra Spanier and Pennsylvania State University. The quotations from letters in Hemingway's Passions are used to provide insight and enrich the listener's understanding of the relationships that were so important to the development of Ernest's character, life experiences, and writing. Because Ernest distinguished between letter writing and writing that counts, he was meticulous in crafting his written work intended for publication, but didn't worry that his personal letters contained slang and grammatical errors. Thus, Ernest's letters, as well as those he received, are reproduced here as they were written and without corrections. Because Ernest became famous at the early age of 26, many recipients saved his letters. Others, because of the emotional content of the correspondence, destroyed them. Domenico Caracciolo, the Italian officer Agnes von Karowski never married, demanded that she burn the letter she received from Ernest. Hadley Richardson, Ernest's first wife, destroyed his early love letters at the time of their divorce. Pauline Pfeiffer, Ernest's second wife, didn't want her correspondence with her famous husband to be immortalized and left instructions that it be burned at the time of her death. All the correspondence did not survive, yet the extant letters serve to paint an informed picture of the personal ambition, heartbreak, and literary triumphs and trials of the iconic American writer. Foreword. When I was asked to write the foreword for Hemingway's Passions, I approached the manuscript with discernment. Covering Ernest Hemingway's life truly requires a particular level of skill and dedication. If not approached and executed properly, the writing would not appropriately depict one of the most profound writers in history. However, in reading these chapters, I became captivated and wholeheartedly agreed to endorse the book. Hemingway's Passions is a remarkable read. I offer that not just because I am his granddaughter, but because it gives Hemingway enthusiasts a profound insight into how Ernest's brain worked and how he told his stories. This book delivers the experience of Hemingway's life through his greatest loves. Nancy Sindelar delves into Ernest's true passions, his women, his wars, and his writing, and how they shaped every choice he made. In Hemingway's Passions, you embark on a journey into the heart of a man whose life was as compelling as the stories he penned. This book is not merely a biography, but an exploration of a soul, my grandfather's, soul, torn between the twin poles of love and death, always writing, always living with unparalleled intensity. Hemingway had an innate passion for passion, a concept that is deeply fascinating to me. He was obsessed with love and equally in love with the danger of facing death. Love and war were unequivocally linked to his perspective, philosophy, and actions. Grace under pressure is a phrase that encapsulates his quest to live more vividly, see more keenly, and feel more deeply than any before him. Whether on the bloody front lines as a journalist or an ambulance driver, or in the savage beauty of the African savannah as a hunter, for Ernest, to face death was to face himself. Upon his returning to the mundaneness of everyday life, the regular world, the only way to reignite that kind of passion was through the electrifying lure of love. The saying about a thin line between love and hatred plays out in this book. After experiencing a love lost or the tragedies of war, only that deep thirst for life would cause someone to courageously continue walking toward the danger. But is facing true love all that different from facing the fears of death? Ernest was constantly excavating these questions, and this brave book leans into those conversations, illuminating such meaningful introspections. While reading this book, I contemplated my grandfather's life and was struck with the parallels between his battles and his romances, each feeding into the other, a perpetual cycle of inspiration that fueled his quest for that one true sentence. Ernest Hemingway courted danger with the zeal of a lover, seeking in its embrace a truth about himself and the world around him. Reflecting on the bittersweet end of his marriage to Hadley, my grandmother, Ernest wrote a poignant expression of love that transcends the pages of A Movable Feast. When I saw my wife again, standing by the tracks as the train came in by the piled logs at the station, I wished I had died before I ever loved anyone but her. She was smiling, the sun on her lovely face tanned by the snow and sun, beautifully built. Her hair red gold in the sun, grown out all winter awkwardly and beautifully. Respectfully, these words sway even more heavily coming from my direct lineage. I am moved to tears when I read that passage because Ernest was writing about the profound love he felt for Hadley. Despite their divorce, that love would last his lifetime. Written toward the twilight of his life, after he was remarried and in the midst of a struggle with mental health and writing, these words reveal a man for whom love was not just a theme, but a lifeline. Even as he navigated the complexities of fame, mental health struggles, and the ceaseless pursuit of artistic perfection, the memory of Hadley remained a touchstone of genuine affection and regret. Also, as an aside, my middle name is Hadley, so I will always cherish that part of his memoir. Ernest made choices to love other women. At a deep level, those choices were a part of his art and his ability to write from a place of rare simplicity and raw emotion. His stories and novels were influenced by his life experiences with each of the women he loved, Agnes, Hadley, Pauline, Martha, and Mary, and those were just his wives. The women who were the center of his passionate love affairs often became his wives, and the other women with whom he had infatuations became further muses, giving him energy and poignant words to build his craft. Those feelings of passion were matched only by the dangers of war or by looking into the face of a lion who would sooner kill him than walk away from the muzzle of his gun. Ernest's stories, whether set against a sun-drenched Spanish bullring or the bleak trenches of the Italian front, were imbued with the authenticity of his experiences and the passions that defined his existence. Each of his loves created experiences and feelings that became his novels. The women of his life became fictional characters that we, as regular laymen, will never forget. Lady Duff Twisden became Lady Brett in The Sun Also Rises, and Agnes inspired A Farewell to Arms. Pauline represents aspects of many of his more well-to-do women in To Have and Have Not, The Short Happy Life of Frances McComber, and more. His muse in the young Adriana became Renata in Across the River and Into the Trees. I am fascinated by the accounts of my grandfather's life, in which he felt the rich were the bane of his, and often his character's, existence. This might be why he continued loving and admiring Hadley throughout his life. They were together before Ernest's success. It was a simple time of hunger, sexual longing, eating or wanting to eat, and a love affair with the city of Paris. Paris, in the 1920s, was a new world of artists, authors, and intellectuals, and it would not be long before he dominated that world. As highlighted in A Movable Feast, his beginning in Paris was pure and poor, yet his passion for life was at its pinnacle. Later, my grandfather became a man of means and lived a comfortable lifestyle that allowed him to care for his wives, children, and ex-wives. The exception was the competitive Martha Gellhorn, who became his nemesis. The two never spoke again after their breakup. However, the comfortable lifestyle didn't align with him intellectually or emotionally, and fueled nothing but frustration, apparent in his later writing. The Sun Also Rises, A Farewell to Arms, Death in the Afternoon, For Whom the Bell Tolls, and finally The Old Man and the Sea, were all fueled by love, war, grace under pressure, or perhaps all three. Battle inspired most of his work, both the internal battle and the ugly external battle of war, and, of course, he was also deeply inspired by the love he felt for the women he cared about and, from my point of view, by the earth he lived on. In his descriptions of locations, whether Spain, the coast of Cuba, or the French Alps, he depicts light, rivers, trees, and waves in a way that proves nothing short of a love affair with nature. I have always felt that if my grandfather were alive today, he would be a powerful environmentalist in love with nature and, given his nature, most likely still in love with some glorious and fabulous woman by his side. If passion was his theme, I see his appreciation of nature as one of his greatest infatuations. I hope that in this book you will find insight into Ernest Hemingway's extraordinary life and a reflection on the enduring power of passion in all its forms. With profound gratitude, I offer this foreword, a bridge between my understanding of Ernest Hemingway and the man you will come to know in the following chapters. May you discover, as I have, more about this remarkable figure, my family's legacy, and perhaps the greatest writer the world has ever known. Mary L. Hemingway, granddaughter of Ernest Hemingway. Prologue. Journalist, adventurer, sportsman, lover. Ernest Hemingway, the Nobel Prize-winning author, embodied many talents and pursued numerous interests during his legendary lifetime. Every chapter of Hemingway's exceptional life was a fresh adventure, usually with a different romantic partner and in a new location that energized his creativity with new experiences, acquaintances, connections, and perspectives. His life formed a series of concentric circles, always moving to interesting places to provide content, settings, and inspiration for new novels, short stories, and nonfiction articles. Ernest's personal experiences became the content of his writing. He developed plots from his adventures, used details from places he lived or visited to create settings, and formed characters based on friends and acquaintances he met along the way. It was dangerous to be Ernest's friend because he frequently transformed friends into controversial characters in one of his novels or short stories. Ernest's first passion was writing, but he also was an adventurer, an outdoorsman, and a keen observer of people. He purposely sought dangerous situations to test his own levels of courage and to discover models for literary heroes that displayed grace under pressure. He tested his physical endurance and courage by skiing through trees, hunting big game in Africa, and even facing bulls in the ring. Grace under pressure was a behavior he studied throughout his life and was demonstrated by his literary heroes, regardless of whether they were facing a wartime enemy, a charging bull, or a great marlin. Ernest defined grace under pressure while skiing in Schruns, Austria, with Gerald Murphy and John Dos Passos. Skiing through trees toward the base of the mountain required the men to not only negotiate the snow and the pitch of the terrain, but also navigate through the trees. Even though Ernest stopped often to check on their well-being, Gerald Murphy and John Dos Passos were terrified by the experience. Ernest, however, found the adventure exhilarating and told his friends he knew what courage was. It was grace under pressure. He felt absolutely elated. As time passed, Ernest not only sought adventures that challenged his physical safety, but also his emotional safety. His risk-taking behavior impacted his personal relationships, but his masculine adventurous spirit appealed to women of all ages, including four wives and a long list of legendary actresses. He was born in 1899, raised in Victorian-era Oak Park, Illinois, but hungered to understand the challenges and actions needed to live in an ever-changing world. He didn't let social conventions stand in his way and fought for his beliefs and wrote about his values. His heroism in the trenches during World War I earned him the Italian Medaglia d'Argento a Valore. His willingness to enter combat areas under fire during World War II earned him a Bronze Star. His courage to write about the good, the bad, and the ugly brought him a Nobel Prize and a Pulitzer Prize for literature. Ernest's tenacity and spirit of adventure were cultivated by his parents and grandfathers, as well as the spouses and companions he chose to befriend throughout his life. As a toddler, Ernest told his mother that he was afraid of nothing, and that, "When I get to be a big boy, I want to go with Dad and shoot lions and wolves." He was born and spent the first 18 years of his life in suburban Oak Park, Illinois, but spent each of those summers at the family cottage in northern Michigan. There, he developed a need for adventure and learned the skills necessary to meet and enjoy the challenges of hunting and fishing. Ernest's father nurtured his son's love of the outdoors, his skills as a marksman, and his love of water. Dr. Hemingway longed to be a medical missionary, but settled for a medical practice in Oak Park and summer spent hunting and fishing in Michigan. He was medical examiner for three insurance companies and the Borden Milk Company, as well as head of obstetrics at Oak Park Hospital, and during his career he delivered more than 3,000 babies. As a youth, Clarence Hemingway spent 3 influential months with the Sioux Indians of South Dakota and developed great admiration for American Indian traditions and culture. As an adult, he won the respect of local Chippewa, Ojibwe tribes that worked in the Michigan logging industry. American Indians were housed in camps that surrounded the Hemingway cottage, and Dr. Hemingway provided pro bono medical services to the injured and the sick. He also earned the name Netektala, or Eagle Eye, because of his excellent marksmanship. Dr. Hemingway's knowledge of the natural world influenced Ernest's lifelong love of hunting and fishing, but it also permeated his writing. The memories of times Ernest spent with his father appear in the Nick Adams stories. In Indian Camp, Nick Adams and his doctor father row across a lake to a nearby Indian camp. Nick's father has been called to deliver a woman who has been in labor for 2 days. At the camp, they find the woman screaming in pain, lying on a bottom bunk bed. Her husband lies above her with a foot injured in a logging accident. To Nick's amazement and shock, his father performs a cesarean with a jackknife and sews the woman up with fishing line. After the baby is delivered, Nick's father turns to help the woman's husband on the top bunk and finds that he fatally slit his own throat with a razor. The story ends with Nick and his father on the lake, rowing away from the camp. Nick, like Ernest, takes comfort in the companionship of his father. They were seated in the boat, Nick in the stern, his father rowing. The sun was coming up over the hills. A bass jumped, making a circle in the water. Nick trailed his hand in the water. It felt warm in the sharp chill of the morning. As they are rowing across the lake, Nick asks his father if dying is hard. His father says, "No, I think it's pretty easy." And Nick concludes that, in the early morning on the lake, sitting in the stern of the boat with his father rowing, he would never die. Ernest also remembered his father and life at Walloon Lake in his short story, Fathers and Sons. He used his own experiences and feelings about hunting and fishing with his father to develop the main character, Nick Adams, saying, "Someone has to give you your first gun or the opportunity to get it and use it, and you have to live where there is game or fish if you are to learn about them." And now, at 38, he loved to fish and to shoot exactly as much as when he first had gone with his father. It was a passion that had never slackened, and he was very grateful to his father for bringing him to know it. He would go on to say that his father came back to him in the fall of the year, or in the early spring when there had been jacksnipe on the prairie, or when he saw shocks of corn, or when the saw a lake, or heard wild geese, or in a duck blind. Dr. Hemingway taught Ernest to hunt, fish, and love the outdoors, but also to understand and respect the dangers inherent in the natural world. The Hemingway children were allowed to have guns at an early age, but Clarence Hemingway understood their potential danger and advised that accidents don't happen to people who know how to handle guns. Treat a gun like a friend. Keep it clean, oil it, clean it after every use, but always remember, it's an enemy if it's carelessly used. Dr. Hemingway's lessons in safety also cultivated Ernest's need for excitement and adventure. During the summers in Michigan, Dr. Hemingway held life-saving drills during which he took his children into deep water, deliberately rocked the boat until it capsized, and forced his children to swim for shore. Ernest and his siblings found their father's life-saving drills exciting. They were keen about the competitive swimming races to shore and, at a young age, learned to exercise grace under pressure. Usually, the family prepared for the summer in Michigan by leaving the Oak Park home, boarding the SS Manitou, and traveling 300 miles north on Lake Michigan to Harbor Springs, Michigan. From there, they traveled by train to Petoskey, and then to Walloon Village and again by boat to the house on Walloon Lake. However, an exception was made to this travel plan in the summer of 1917, when only the Hemingway girls traveled to Walloon Lake by steamer. Though there were no gas stations, a few hotels, and mostly unpaved roads, Ernest, his father, his mother, and his younger brother Lester made the summer journey in the new family car, a Ford Model T touring car. The 487-mile journey took 5 days. The family camped in tents at night and brought along a saw so that Ernest could cut branches to provide traction for the car on the sandy roads of northern Michigan. Ernest's mother, Grace Hall Hemingway, made the trip in the Model T and embraced life in Michigan, but she also liked to think of herself as an English gentlewoman. Her parents emigrated from England and eventually built the Queen Anne House with a turret and 6 bedrooms in Oak Park. Grace grew up in that house, then raised the first 4 of her 6 children there. In Oak Park, she followed the English tradition of celebrating Boxing Day and was a member of the 19th Century Women's Club and the Oak Park Art League. But she also embraced life at the isolated Michigan cottage she called Windermere, which was lit only by oil lamps and heated with a fireplace. While she loved music and organized a family orchestra in the parlor of her Oak Park home, she also had her own .22 rifle, fished for pike and lake trout in Michigan, and nurtured her son's love of the outdoors. A few weeks before his 3rd birthday, she wrote, "Ernest shoots well with his gun and loads it and cocks it himself and has wonderful courage and endurance while fishing at Windermere." Grace loved music and had a beautiful voice. After high school, she trained for opera with Madame Luisa Cappiani in New York and gave a recital at Madison Square Garden, but was bothered by the glaring footlights and decided to return to Oak Park and marry Clarence Hemingway, who then moved to Grace's family's home. Grace continued to pursue her interest in music by giving voice lessons and organizing the church choirs. However, when her father died, she used her inheritance to build her 4,500-square-foot dream home. Ernest's 1906 boyhood home reflects the prairie-style influence of neighbor and architect Frank Lloyd Wright, who lived in Oak Park from 1889 to 1909, and exhibits the typical prairie-style features of overhanging eaves and stucco facades with horizontal wood trim. The 15-room house included a 30-by-30-foot music room with a 2-story-high balcony for recitals and concerts. When the new house was finished, the family held a small ceremony to light the fire on the hearthstone. Marceline and Ernest sang 2 songs, and then the house was blessed and dedicated to a happy family life. The music room was Grace's joy, and the tradition of family concerts continued. When Grace decided a cello was needed to provide depth for performances, Ernest was given a cello and required to practice a 30 minutes a day, eventually graduating to a 1 hour of daily practice. According to his brother Lester, Ernest later attributed the tedious practice sessions to the initiation of his writing career. When people would ask him how he got started writing, his stock answer was, "Part of my success I owe to the hours when I was alone in the music room and was supposed to be practicing. I'd be doing my thinking while playing pop
Sample complete. Ready to continue?